Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. This episode features Joe Thomas, the director of the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership at the U.S. Naval Academy, as he talks to Professor Tim Lassiter about the vital role of empathy and cultural competency in leadership.
We're going to get started, actually, with you elaborating a large part of what I've heard you speak in the classroom. You started with public servant leadership. I've heard you do a session on that. Mm-hmm. Is that different than leadership otherwise?
Yeah, I've got mixed feelings on that. So leadership is leadership in one sense, in that there are certain universal principles of, you know, best practices in leadership. But context matters, of course, and I think leadership in the public sector, whether it be federal, state, local, whatever the case may be, there are certain requirements and certain demands when, as they say, you don the cloth of the nation, for example, whether that be in uniform or cloth like this, you're representing different interests, and there's probably some additional demands, especially when the role requires that you take an oath to the Constitution. At the front end of that service. So slightly different demands, context matters, leadership is modified that way.
Well, we have different contexts, right?
Yeah.
You're teaching at the Naval Academy, there'll be lieutenants?
There'll be ensigns in the Navy ensigns. Or second lieutenants in the Marine Corps. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And
we hire all of our graduates, as we say.
Yeah. They don't have a big career development office.
That's right.
While mine are a lot of, I teach mostly MBAs, we teach together in executive programs. Do you think there's a difference between your students and my students that we need to think about as we think about leadership?
I don't think so. Again, the universal aspects, the parts that transcend these different contexts, I think outnumber the things that are very unique and specific. I say that, but I also just mentioned that context matters. But the universal things are the things probably that are best for the conversation. And those universal things have to do with human relationships. Those universal things have to do with making sound decisions in a timely way, communicating effectively, and so on. Those broad type of skills, I think, are exercised regardless of the context in which you work.
Well, one of the things we're going to do an audible here a bit from the normal way we run these things. Rather than 45 minutes and then Q&A, I've got a number of themes here that at Darden we call them pastures, moving from one topic to another topic as we spend our 85 minutes in the classroom. And to get you guys engaged, I want to hear you more talking. So are there, anybody have a particular question about public servant leadership? And is servant leadership different in the commercial world than in the government sector? Concerns or questions about that? Well, that means we're just going to get to talk. But here we go.
So for me, it's interesting because, I mean, and of course there's a difference here between, you know, political appointees and career appointees. But when you're looking at, you know, a public sector leader, I think for so many, I mean, really their job is to implement whatever the sort of, you know, elected leadership decides they want.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I mean, my question would be how, when I look at private sector leaders, I think of something that's much more obviously strategic. And when I look at like public sector leaders, I sort of see, you know, something that's much more focused on implementing. I guess what I'm asking, when you're looking at like a public sector, you know, person whose, you know, responsibility is to sort of implement, you know, political leadership, where is the room or where is the scope for that leadership when so much of what you're supposed to do, you know, when you make that oath to the Constitution, is to implement somebody else's vision.
There may be less of a gap here, though, than imagined. I'll defer the part of the private sector, too, to our professor of practice, Tim. But in the end, implementing policy applies, I think, in the private sector as well as the public sector, right? You're still beholden to kind of a higher authority either way. I think public sector leaders, for the most part, Again, the distinction, as mentioned, is kind of you take the oath to the Constitution. So aligning on the notion of the rule of law, aligning on the fact that you are you're serving the public trust in that sense is a reminder. But I think you're doing the same thing in the private sector as well, right? You're aligning on the values of the company. You're trying to ensure shareholder value. You're trying to maintain principles, values, and so on that the company stands for. So maybe there's less daylight between those two things than there actually is. But to your point on public sector leaders below the elected officials, even political appointees, I would say, are still responsible to that higher calling. You're kind of a standard bearer of the profession as well as being a leader in the traditional sense. And as a standard bearer, specifically if you're fairly senior in government, as appointees are, there's a higher purpose, there's a higher calling. You have to understand the profession, the nature of the profession, as well as the day-to-day tactical things that are done regardless of your job. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with that. There's another hand too.
Yep, we have another hand.
Hi, thanks so much for being here. So my question is kind of along the same vein that you're talking about. Public service leaders are made to reflect like the will of the people and rule the people. There's a lot of, honor in that. And I think a lot of people right now in our country are frustrated, feeling that the will of the people is not necessarily being reflected by a lot of leaders. A lot of things happening with women's bodies, just to name one. So I'm just kind of curious, your take on changing that and your perspective on that, like what you've seen and kind of why we're here.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was a deep one.
It is deep. It is deep. But a really, really good question. So I think at the heart of what you asked too is what happens to public sector leaders when they have very fundamental disagreements about laws, policies, and so on, or everything about the elected officials that may be in charge at the time. I think it's important to stay focused. Again, the conversations we have, whether they be with midshipmen, the students at the Naval Academy, or in other settings with public sector professionals, is we spend so much time talking about the Constitution as kind of a moral reference point, a reference point to duty. In other countries, for example, say Canada, in European Union countries, in those settings, civil servants refer to themselves without blushing as bureaucrats, right? Bureaucrat has kind of a negative ring to it, doesn't it? It has a pejorative kind of tone. In the U.S., being a bureaucrat would mean that you're just kind of a slave to policy and procedure and so on. You kind of get caught up in these restrictions and requirements. We think that term implies that you don't think for yourself. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a civil servant, a public servant in the American context that would refer to themselves that way. They refer to themselves as public servants. And I think it's for that reason, because in the U.S. we do take that oath to the Constitution, and rule of law is so important. Now, we don't always agree with the laws that happen, but those at least theoretically reflect the will of the people, at least the elected representatives of the people, and they're all transitory. They come and go. So the ones you agree with today, they'll probably change. As the ones that you don't agree with today, odds are pretty good they'll change. That's the nature of our representative democracy too. It's constantly morphing. And that in the end is, in spite of things that really stand out as disturbing to us, in the end it's the nature of that change though that I think I take faith in, or at least I take some comfort in, that nothing is permanent in our system.
Yeah, and this ideological is part of the thing we want to touch on. We'll hit that on some different dimensions. I think I'll move to another pasture in the sense of military itself. I think cutting the distinction between the students you teach and I teach, to some extent, so they're swearing to the Constitution. We have an issue of, is it all about shareholders or is it stakeholders, and how do we actually guide those in the commercial world to make judgments around the trade-offs that exist in life?
Social responsibility.
So the military today, a book recently my brother-in-law pointed me to, he's a West Pointer, my brother's a West Pointer, and I have a nephew who's a Air Force Academy. A lot of military ties, and I think of those people as people who've chosen a level of chosen to take a service role very clearly. And a book he suggested was Looking for the Good War, about how we like to glorify war at some point in the past. And I think there's problems with that, but at the same time, we have less than 1% of the population have been in the are serving the military today, which is quite different than we had back during World War II kind of view. How do we, is the military an important role, or is that a plus or a minus that we think about service as a part of how we build a common ideology?
Yeah. Well, the part that you mentioned about glorifying war, that's certainly not something that we use in preparation of warriors for war, right? That's something that's usually, you know, the work of fiction, or it's the work of somebody for whatever purposes, sometimes nefarious purposes, to kind of whip up support for policies and wars and things like that. But it's a perfect example too of a small cross section of public sector professionals wear military uniforms, and in that case, for sure, we try to ensure that they understand very, very clearly that they need to be absolutely objective in their service and how they approach the idea of service, that they are nonpartisan, apolitical in every possible way. There was a great tradition in the U.S. Regarding those who wore military uniforms for decades, centuries practically speaking, where military officers, leaders in the military, didn't even vote. Through the chief of staff of the Army in the Second World War, George C. Marshall, it was a personal policy. In fact, he recommended that military leaders don't vote. Now, we've changed that dynamic somewhat in that we do encourage soldiers, sailors, Marines to vote. But we certainly monitor very closely any type of political activity. And it becomes there's certainly very high visibility things that have happened over the course of the past couple of years that have had a military stamp on them. That's deeply disturbing to those of us who prepare folks for leadership roles in this sense. So being apolitical is important for both military and civilian public servants, but on the military side, it's certainly something that distinguishes this country in very, very important ways. So we hold very, very dear to that. And it's a deliberate, conscious part of the educational process, not just at the service academies, but everywhere across the military.
Yeah. So questions around this service, I mean, the stakeholder and stockholder is clearly a topic I'm interested in talking further about from a business context.
Hey, sir, this was a lot louder than I expected. based on hyper-military, but I think it'd be expanded out to the private sector. So I'm interested in the span since you've been teaching since 2003 at the Academy?
Yes, yep. Yep.
So when I was at Severn Vo-Tech back in the 90s, everything was very abstract. It was flashing back to lessons from World War II and Vietnam. But your era has been the era of people who you're getting company officers back. You're getting faculty who spent their entire professional career in war.
That's correct.
And not just a war, but a very ambiguous war, a war with a lot of moral hazard. So I found it interesting when you said that, you know, the things that are the same are outnumber the things that are different. But through your span, in particular as we're transitioning now to back to kind of great power style warfare, have you noticed the transition in the way that you're teaching leadership? And do you think that that's the right thing, or do you think that's the wrong thing? And I get kind of back to like what I said, my era, it was very abstract, whereas you got the chance to be hyper-specific. Do you see it going back to the abstract?
Yeah, that's a very powerful way to frame it, from going from the abstract, talking about war in theory, to to having our students engage directly with folks who kind of bear the scars of war. An example is, he mentions company officers. Company officer is, the student body is kind of divided into these 30 companies. It's roughly based on Dunbar's number. 150 people are really who you can get to know socially, probably. So they really identify with this size of an organization called a company. And they'll have an officer and a senior non-commissioned officer, or chief petty officer, who kind of lives with them. And we've had company officers that are decorated for valor, incredible stories, decorated for valor. We've had company officers who've been double amputees. I've had teaching assistants, double amputee, teaching assistants still in uniform. I had one, an absolute hero of mine, young lieutenant, retired lieutenant named Brad Snyder, explosive ordnance disposal officer in the Navy, permanently blinded. But to give you a sense of his character, he refers to being blinded, 100% blinded, in combat in Afghanistan as the best thing that had ever happened to him. But the way he unpacks the story is that it gave him incredible focus in life. Prior to that, he was casting about a little bit. He was a rock star in his own right. He was captain of the swim team at the Naval Academy, did phenomenal things in his career. But in his mind, he was casting about. He became utterly focused since then. And I'm proud to say he's not only a 3 or 4-time Paralympic gold medalist at this point. He served as my teaching assistant for some time. We hosted him in my organization, the Stockdale Center. He's on the National Olympic Committee right now, helping them make decisions, and kind of midway through a PhD at Princeton at the moment. So not a slacker. The point is, when you take people like that and expose them to midshipmen, this notion of glorious warfare disappears in an instant. When they see their company officer, who they live with, out there on his prosthetics running with them, or this blind officer teaching classes on what it means to be a warrior. He and I co-taught an elective course called Code of the Warrior, where we examined centuries of warrior traditions and what it meant to not exercise unrestrained fighting, but what it meant to restrain appropriately war fighting. Because that's an important distinction I share with students all the time. Your job, for example, my background is in the Marine Corps, your job as a young Marine officer is more about constraining violence. And that sounds really strange. And it sounds almost like, what are you selling out to this? It doesn't recognize the realities of warfare. Well, yeah, it does. Human nature is such that violence happens, particularly in a context like that. An officer's job, a leader's job, is to ensure it's appropriate, to ensure that we're, for example, not harming non-combatants or post-combatants, those who have surrendered and things like that, because, well, we pride ourselves in doing things the right way for the right reasons, the good guys, so to speak, right? As opposed to what you see playing out on the world stage right now in Eastern Europe, right? When you see tactics being used in Ukraine where cities and towns are intentionally targeted, we'd like to think we're the antithesis of that approach. And to be that, because of the nature of humanity or inhumanity in situations like this, it takes a lot of investment, a lot of serious investment in that professional development of those future warriors. And I give a perfect example of this. And I'll give an example of active warriors. One of the past jobs that I had a number of years ago was to directed the Marine Corps Leadership Ethics and Law of Armed Combat Center in Quantico, Virginia, not far from where we are right now, the John A. Lejeune Leadership Institute. And one of the more daunting tasks in that role was to talk about the law of armed conflict and ethics to young Marines who were about to step off into combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And oftentimes they'd gather them in large theaters. I'd go to Camp Pendleton, San Diego, or Camp Lejeune down in North Carolina, and talk to folks who had, chances are, had done a tour or two or three in combat prior to me coming in dressed like this, because I'm retired from the Marine Corps. It's a hard sell in that sense already. But when I pop in there, I'd start the conversation with, you ever hear the old saying that I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6? Have any of you heard that before? You know what that signifies? I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6, which is to imply that I'd rather be taken to a court-martial based on some decision I made while I was downrange or in harm's way and tried by a jury of my peers, so to speak, than be carried by 6 pallbearers and planted here next door at Arlington. Right? That risk calculation, I'm going to err on the side of doing something that saves my own life and the lives of my fellow Marines in combat, right? And when I asked that question, 600 heads in this theater would nod north and south. Makes total sense. I'd say, yeah, I see all of you shaking your head for a reason, because it is common sense. But guess what? We're already asking you to do some really unreasonable things, like risk your life for what amounts to be essentially sub-minimum wage, when you really balance it all out on the deployment, right? Now we're asking you to exercise restraint, keeping your finger off the trigger for a little bit longer, discrimination, which takes time, adds additional risk, discrimination that is between combatants and non-combatants or post-combatants, and proportionality, choosing the right weapon system. Again, we don't blanket towns, villages with artillery or rockets. So all of that incurs additional risk to you and the people you lead, the people on your left and right. That's a really hard sell, but it's a sell that, in my personal experience, is certainly not impossible, and certainly one that when we engage in dialogue, much like we're having right now, works. And I think that is at the essence, that's the ingredient in many ways of the success that we have enjoyed, that we have maintained a moral force, generally speaking. Now, there's certainly aberrations to that. We could throw out examples like Abu Ghraib, if you're familiar with that, the abuse of prisoners in Iraq, kind of at the height of the Iraq war, and there's all sorts of other examples of it. But fortunately, there are anomalies. And fortunately, I think the U.S. Department of Defense, the military services, take those so seriously that we conduct, just like your case studies that you teach in a business school, we conduct very thorough reviews and build cases around that. So I think that's something that all Americans really should take heart in, because we do invest so much time, energy, resources in that effort.
Well, that segues nicely to another theme. I mean, when I think about your story there about the analytic choice,
yeah,
of rational choice between judged by 12 or carried by 6, I remember some research, probably was an NPR article, I'll have to, radio show probably, but about who goes and risks their lives to save other people, breaking people out of a car that's burning but could explode, climbing through a fence and getting, because somebody was getting mauled by a bull with nothing but a stick to go help save some other people. And they did the research around it, and the issue was never about, none of those people that did that did a calculation about the risk of this or not. It was that they had been raised.
Yeah.
It was in their character and their virtues, yeah, their view that that's what you do as a human, is you go and risk yourself to help somebody else if you think, if you can, just immediately.
Yeah.
And I think that segues to one of the other themes we had, is character virtues is actually a large part of your whole teaching philosophy and research, yeah, that you're launching at Scottsdale, upcoming around a whole chapter of things. And I was amazed, the multi-character nature of it, it includes everything from a theology to veterinary medicine on a book around character virtues.
Yep.
And so my question is, first is, what are you most excited about that? And then let's talk about virtues again more broadly, I think, and why,
yeah,
that's important.
Well, character isn't that one of these terms that that we use all the time. We bandy about this term, and oftentimes it has very little meaning. But the good news story about character, the notion of character, is there are thousands of years of really bright people who have tried to dissect this character, this notion of character, unpack the idea of character. And what we do in this research that we're about to set out on for the next academic year, this is going to be the one we do a deep dive. We choose one particular topic related to military ethics, particularly each year. And character development and assessment is next year's project. But it's going to start with a grounding in what Aristotle believed to be, you know, character. That is to say, we are the product of our habits. For example, it's referred to as aretaic philosophy. Arete is excellence, moral excellence in this case. We are what we practice day in, day out. We'll start there. We'll look in, look at other frames of reference about character, and then we'll talk about how we're going to assess it in our own folks. There's a whole lot of work done, not just in military settings in the U.S. right now. Character is a point of fascination in American K through 12 education. There's some controversy. Can it be developed? Should it be developed? Relativism is very strong in K through 12 for good reasons. Moral relativism, that is to say, that the grounding that, well, who am I to judge? People have different backgrounds and so on, which is understandable in terms of tolerance. I get that completely. But in terms of our students, again, because we hire all of our students, we say, well, we probably have to put a stake in the ground at some point and determine right from wrong, right? We have to determine those things that are beyond the virtues, beyond the standards that the nation expects of you. There are certain codes of conduct that we adhere to. Heck, the center you know, that I work in is named for James B. Stockdale. He is a noted Congressional Medal of Honor recipient, prisoner of war in Vietnam for nearly 8 years, and he's a classic case of a warrior philosopher because he said that the thing that saved his life and helped enabled him to save the lives of countless other prisoners of war is the study of the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, right? A Greek former slave, lived in Rome, became a philosopher, and essentially is one of the key thinkers behind this notion that concern yourself only with that which you can control. Right? So Stockdale takes this, uses it in the laboratory of practice, the Hanoi Hilton, the infamous Hanoi Hilton, and saves hundreds probably of lives in the process just through exercising leadership informed by this ancient philosophy. So that's kind of a...
Sounds like a good place to start.
It's an inspiration to us. It's certainly an inspiration on the Navy and Marine Corps side, I would say, to all Americans, to what good leadership can actually accomplish.
We'll turn to questions after this, but empathy is one of the characteristics that you particularly have an emphasis here. I think I've heard you say it's maybe one of the most important leadership characteristics.
Quite possibly the most important. A lot of ways to define empathy, but and empathy is also in relation to other terms. Sympathy is lesser than empathy in my mind. Sympathy is just feeling badly for the plight of somebody else, right? Which is an important human emotion to have. Your ability to see that the misfortune of others. Empathy, though, is trying to project your experience into that, right? In some way, feeling for them, and perhaps, you know, the next level in that is the notion of compassion, which is acting on this feeling now. And I think in military settings, in any settings, empathy, and I'm talking about emotional empathy now, is a critical component of leadership. It's a critical component. It may sound funny or strange to some for a retired Marine to say this, but empathy and love are at the heart of leadership. And I talk and tell students at the undergraduate level or exec ed, whatever it might be, I said, if you can't talk about love, love as in the best interests of those that you're responsible for, you're probably in the wrong business. Right? You should be able to talk about love without blushing, as they say, because that is the operative principle behind it. Empathy is a way to act on that love, to see something from someone else's perspective. And that's just emotional empathy. Cognitive empathy, right, or perspective taking, is the willingness and ability to see someone else's point of view without injecting your own judgment into it. Right? And that's the other half of this concept. And not just an essential element to leadership, but a cure for what ails us as a country in many ways. Because we talk past each other. This is a result of the lack of cognitive empathy or lack of perspective taking. There's a lot of ways to solve problems, to think about the problems of the nation. And nobody has a corner on the market when it comes to good ideas. So listening to each other would help tremendously in this sense.
I have very few mirror neurons, so natural empathy doesn't come, but cognitive I work on really hard.
Yeah.
This is a topic, maybe some more questions might come out. Is this something that's relevant for business leaders? I know we've got a mix of people from the public sector and the business, and we got some MBAs, we got some Darden residential MBAs as well. Thoughts, is character something that needs to be on the agenda only at the Naval Academy, or is it also in business education? How do we think about that? Any questions about that? Yeah, I see a hand here. Sorry. Ooh.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big advocate. Mainly, my daughter's in kindergarten, and we started her at a classical school, which is emphasizing character development for kids in pre-K. Kind of to your point, where there's a wide array of kind of pedagogies within the K through 12 classroom. And part of it, our choice was, we had a better sense of what we weren't going to get. So where we could control character education, control character development within our family. So whereas if we went to a public school, at least in our area, it could change every year. Right. And that's a really difficult thing to navigate with kids that are growing up. I grew up in public school, so it was very different. But it was just kind of in lower education. I think for professional education, the classical education model was something that has changed across some generations in my learning about it. And so you have a lot of folks that are in certain younger generations now where that model was not necessarily in place. And so you get a lot of folks that are coming into their 20s and their professional careers, and they are having to navigate situations which are really difficult to navigate. And they don't necessarily have the language or the vernacular to navigate some of those conversations. And so the default is only relativism. And in some of our cases, sometimes you have to say, no, that's not right. Like, that is wrong. You can't treat someone like that, regardless of your perspective. So I do think it has an important place.
Yeah. On the idea of classical education, I mean, I know one of your areas of interest is hubris, the idea of excessive pride, and I think it's the height of hubris to ignore thousands of years of thinking and best practice on how to get along with one another. It's something basic like that. And even the first part where you talk about character, we hang a lot of different names, faddish names. Like, there's a fad for one thing or another. An example might be emotional intelligence, a really powerful concept, right? That begins with self-awareness, self-assessment, being able to modulate one's emotions and how you deal with people around you. And only then, after you've kind of mastered self, being able to recognize emotions in others and to make sense of it that way. Well, there are many classical philosophers that would say, well, that's character. That's being able to moderate your own behaviors and recognize behaviors in others and help them to reach some type of higher functioning. That's character. So we sometimes change the names of these things, and I think at our own peril reject things just because they're old ideas. To me, that's the height of hubris.
Well, and you're not listing a checklist of 200 things you have to do to be a good person. But empathy sounds like a pretty solid baseline of that should be something we should all have.
It's a mindset.
Right, it's a mindset.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something. I'm going to call you, but I'm going to cold call Will, one of my Darden students who just came back from Germany with us. We were studying artificial intelligence, robotics, and technological unemployment, and we were in Berlin exploring businesses' role in how society is shaped and histories of war in Berlin and whatnot. How important do you think the character side of the equation is for MBA students versus?
I think it's a big deal, especially traveling around Germany. I think business leaders were very cognizant of politics and the extremes of politics.
Yeah.
And I was curious, I was going to ask this question.
You have the mic, so it's your chance to do
it.
How you see the role of politics and maybe through a moral lens in the military and sort of in the defense sector overall.
That's a classic, clever Darden student who actually did a real short answer and then put a question back.
Yeah, that's right. That's well played. Yeah, so, you know, I go back to when it comes to politics, again, there's, for some of us, there's kind of a pejorative tone to that that term as well, because it does imply a couple of things, being transitory too, like moving and changing and not necessarily pegged in the way a moral compass would be pegged, right? The metaphor there being to pointing to true north, telling you what's right, where politics moves with the will of people, individuals, whatever. Sometimes in a positive direction, and Germany is of course a great example of that, right? So to tie this back, history is ever present in Germany. It's ever present in many places, but in Germany in particular, right? Because of the incredible tragedy. Well, the study there, the case study there, is how an individual, and of course there's much precedent for it, but how political will goes from an expression of the interest of the people to the interest of a few, then ultimately to the interest of one. And once public servants, once civil servants surrender the idea of the rule of law and start swearing allegiance to an individual as opposed to the concept of the Constitution, well, that's a quick path to hell, clearly. And the object lessons there, I think we use those in our own classroom. We're getting ready pretty soon here in a couple weeks to kick off the kind of process of acculturation we refer to as plebe summer, kind of like a boot camp experience. Bring them all together, you know, they're all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, straight out of high school, and then slap them with cold reality. Among the slaps of cold reality is a visit right here, close to where we are now, to the Holocaust Museum. And we talk about the idea, the notion of blind obedience to orders creates this, as an example. That's not the only place where we try to bring out object lessons from American history as well, where blind obedience to orders. So, for example, much of the time I've spent at the Naval Academy is in the ethics classroom. And we differentiate ethics in pretty important ways, the development of ethics, beyond where most organizations, public sector or private sector, compliance ethics, that's the start. That's the floor, you know, paying attention to black letter law, the do's and don'ts, absolute bare minimum. We're not trying to create minimalists when it comes to this. We're talking about moral responsibility. What's the higher calling of what you do? And it certainly goes beyond mere compliance. It has to be some type of moral maturity where you understand the very purpose behind those orders that you receive. Moral understanding, certainly. And then the ability to act on those things, that's the crux, that's the key. And I think the more we take folks to the Holocaust Museum and expose them to, a couple summers ago we did a civil rights staff ride. This is mainly for faculty, but we do this with midshipmen as well, to look at some of the gross mistakes we've made in our experiment in democracy. You know, clearly there's been a lot of those. And this is not to somehow imply that we are unalterably flawed as a nation. It's anything but that. It's that we learn from this. We learn from our failings. We correct these things as we kind of move along. And I think that's an important lesson.
I think that's a lesson that came home in Germany for us as well. We were at a concentration camp that was early on for just dissenters to the Nazi Party.
Right.
And slave laborers who were working for businesses, and they wanted cheap labor, was kind of how our guide is talking to us about it. And when I pushed back, trying to understand further about how much power the Nazi Party had, and I asked what percentage of the people were in the Nazi Party when Hitler came to took his rise. Any guesses? What percentage of the German population were in the Nazi Party? 2.5%. What percent of the German population was Jewish? Less than 1%. So 2.5% deciding to blame 1% sent a country in turmoil and the world in turmoil, right? So stepping back to think about what our role is and checks and balances of how we actually manage these things, it's a complicated issue, and we actually have to have some kinds of groundings to think about these kinds of problems. It's not just going to the polls, I think, as well.
Yeah, right.
I saw him back here. Said I'd come to you.
So back to the, I think the compassion and empathy piece was striking to me. So I'm in the healthcare industry. I think people are told treat your patients with compassion. So that actually is typically the way they frame it. I like the empathy piece a little bit more because a healthcare provider in whatever level they serve, they need to be able to go above and beyond and almost pretend like this old lady that I'm caring for, what if it was my grandmother? Like, that's the way I should treat them. But I think right now we're at a point of compassion. I think there's so much more to go. And I think it comes from you dehumanize your job a lot because it becomes routine. So, you're just, processing patient after patient, so it just become transactions to you at some point. And at least my organization, I think, has a lot of work to do on that. I'm just wondering, any strategies that you've seen that have actually worked to make people think about that purpose, higher purpose of what they do, as opposed to the day-to-day that they have, because it's easy to disconnect from that when you do your job.
Yeah.
But that should be some kind of cultural thing that, I'm not asking for a silver bullet, because I'm sure every organization is different, but there's got to be some strategies that work more than others.
Sure. Well, you use the word dehumanizing, right? So this has direct bearing to an earlier question. We're coming through 20 years of wars, right? And they're different. The wars of the past couple of decades are decidedly different from many of the wars that preceded. The example I'll often use is in the Second World War, a Marine Corps example, the island of Iwo Jima. There were no non-combatants on that island by the time that fight took place. It was pretty straightforward for those Marines about to step off, certainly for the leaders. Anything not in the same color uniform that you have, kill it, period. Everything's a combatant. It's a landing, it's no quarter war. It's the worst of all circumstances in that sense. It's just a no quarter, as in nobody's surrendering at that stage of the game. Nobody's surrendering, nobody's accepting surrenders at that point. The nature of the fight in the 21st century has been anything but that, right? So one of the great things to be aware of is the fact, even more so clearly than in the healthcare field, is the tendency to dehumanize everybody when you deploy to places that are so utterly unfamiliar to you that it's unimaginable how different they are from your experience as Americans. And ensuring that they hear the stories, that they experience non-combatants, locals, understand the culture, I think is in some ways job one, right? Maybe job two. After the skills required to defend yourself and to fight, you really do have to understand what it is that you're there for. And it's not just war fighting. Right? There's got to be some kind of higher calling to it. And as Tim mentioned before, whether it's a book or so on, I've become convinced for many years, one of the real keys to all of this, and it's deeply related, it's tied to the idea of empathy, is the notion of cross-cultural competence. So we spend a lot of time, in fact, it's been a point of research interest of mine and a colleague of mine.
A forthcoming book.
And a book coming out, a colleague of mine at the Naval Academy, she teaches cultural anthropology and languages. But we have similar approaches in that the Naval Academy enables us to take students in small numbers every summer to immerse ourselves in a culture unlike our own. So my shtick, so to speak, is that I take midshipmen to remote cultures and austere environments, because I refer to those types of cultures as cultures written with a darker pen, so that they experience on the ground level, living, sleeping, traveling in the ways that locals travel. And these are places that are these aren't windshield tours in Paris, right? These are very remote locations. The one next year set up for Papua New Guinea and Louisiana Archipelago, where they don't even use currency, right? So you barter, we barter for our food with D cell batteries because that's a value. I have found, and I've done many of these over the years. I've been doing it for 15 plus years now. I have found that inherently builds empathy. They see the humanity by living among, I don't know, live among the Bedouin, live and travel among the Bedouin in Jordan. I took a group to live among the Tuareg in Morocco, the Quechua people in Peru and things like that. And without fail, these midshipmen come away from these experiences like there's deep wisdom in this culture. And everybody they may have interacted with is illiterate, like can't read, but they see and they believe the deep, deep wisdom. They experience deep wisdom, and they come away changed. I come away changed every year. And it's a long explanation to say it's stories of humanity, right? It's experiencing the humanity. It's reminding ourselves. So professional development, continuing education credits, shouldn't just be focused on technical matters. They should be focused on human matters. And I think our experience, at least mine, with these cultural immersions, ensures that we touch the humanity of as many and as different a culture as we possibly can. And I do it every summer.
You know. Yeah, and just to build on that, in the business school world, I think a lot of what we, particularly in operations, one of my big hot buttons is don't treat people as units of capacity. It's really easy when we're doing numbers to think about this units of capacity. And one of the reasons we go to Germany, Germany has been much more focused on automating, and they push jobs out in automated jobs away, but they have twice the percentage of their population working in high-paying manufacturing jobs in the U.S. They didn't outsource. Now, that may be a long-term downside in views, but thinking about the broader trade-offs of what we're trying to accomplish and not treating people as units of capacity, and much like Japanese term is go and see that we talk about in operations as well, go and see Genchi Genbutsu, but that's again back to our ideological bubbles. We're too much in one circle and we don't understand how the other people are. There's not enough cross-bubble. And I would tell you the vast majority of my students have never set foot inside of a factory and worked with frontline employees. And they're going to be managers and hedge fund folks. They don't have that first-hand experience because it just isn't happening through the natural processes these days. Is it? It probably did 50 years ago more than it does today. So that's part of that empathy and exposure is, I think, a big part of how we break some of these bubbles. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how do you compel someone who has succeeded based on lack of empathy to want to change? So I'm thinking of like a CEO who's risen in a company being selfish and not showcasing empathy and leading with empathy and has really made their career based on that. How do you get them once they're at the top to want to partake in one of these experiences and make a change?
Do you want to handle that one? I mean, this is a private sector thing, so I've got thoughts, but
gets us back to hubris. I actually believe that one of the challenges I did an article after some research driven from some consulting actually with a former classmate of mine who advanced to the top and was a billionaire and his company came tumbling back down. But part of the view is how do you separate confidence from hubris? And when we went and looked at I didn't know the academic research because I'm a professor of practice and a consultant, but my colleagues exposed me to it. And so some of the symbols, narcissism is clearly a dangerous sign that somebody's more hubris instead of just highly confident. Because people who are successful are probably highly confident for good reasons. A second dimension is a negative dimension we find is dismissiveness, which again, you don't have the empathy, you're not listening to other people. Those are two negative signs. And then the positive signs I like to focus is humility. And I think Honda's founder was one of those great examples of that for me. And then kind of curiosity. Intellectual curiosity and kind of a willingness to explore. I think Amazon, as many bad things as Amazon has going on it, as a company culture is we're going to experiment. We're constantly trying to figure out what's going on with a very clear focus on the customer. Now, they may not be doing everything right for their employees at times, but they're at least trying to do the intellectual curiosity. So I think those are the things. I'm hopeful that actually what we're teaching is that we don't have companies where people who have zero empathy are growing to the top. I don't think it's, I mean, that's part of your thesis. Ultimately, you're not going to be successful if you don't have empathy, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think some do. Some narcissists, heck, some sociopaths rise to the levels of significant senior responsibility, right? I'll give you an example, though. I think in the military, something that it started in the Army, and the Army is kind of mastered this, and the Navy is taking a page from this book and others. They're, in order to kind of wring out toxic leadership at the battalion command level, so that's leadership of an organization. It varies, but let's just say 750 to 1,000 people, soldiers, right? The traditional ways of selecting leaders, battalion commanders for that level, oftentimes rendered folks that you kind of describe, who we find out only after they go into command that they are narcissistic, utterly lack empathy, chew up soldiers and spit them out. Well, the Army, and I got to give props to West Point. They've done incredible research on this, and the person up there that runs their Department of Behavioral Sciences and Leadership, Colonel Everett Spain, has kind of been instrumental to this, published a big article a few issues ago in Harvard Business Review with the findings. They call it the Brigade Assessment Program, I believe, or a Battalion Command Assessment Program, BCAP, Battalion Command Assessment Program, where they bring in psychologists and other perspectives to do non-traditional assessments of people being considered for such critical positions of leadership. And they look at them from a variety of angles. And I think building in things prior to, such as 360-degree evaluations, right, which is popular in the private sector, at least in some circles, and it's growing in popularity in the military. Because if we just use traditional performance evaluation, top-down performance evaluation, well, we know part of what creates the thing that you mentioned is the tendency for some people to kiss up and kick down, right? You're not gonna see that unless you get some type of feedback from those being kicked in the process. So a 360 is important. There's incredible investments being made, and I would never have guessed this when I started out in this, incredible investments being made, and we're doing the same at the Naval Academy in coaching. Executive and leadership coaching, where it's a one-on-one conversation, it's a kind of an inquiring conversation, not a telling conversation, but drawing out, getting people to think about how they're landing, how they're impacting other people. My prediction is we went from like zero investment in coaching, you know, just 5, 6, 10 years ago, to now this is something that is catching on in massive ways. And I think these individual investments, coaching investments with disinterested third parties who come in and draw from them kind of self-reflection, I think this dynamic is starting to change. And I think any company, especially if it's like a publicly traded company, you got a board, you have things like this, 360 evaluations, if that board is not driving some type of executive coaching to address issues like that, well, I think the whole business is in peril when you don't do that. Because sooner or later, you know, the effect of that is felt in the bottom line. I'd like to think there is justice in the universe, right? That sooner or later you're going to get your comeuppance if you treat people badly long enough. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. But any way you can kind of nudge things in that direction so that justice is ultimately served, that's a win.
And you've shared some of the research about coaching. That's the Doar Institute, I think, is.
Yeah, Rice University, right? Yeah.
But
yeah.
Partly what I think about coaching, and I hope it's what we try to do at Darden, is what we view, it's not what to think, but what to think about is what our job is. So a lot of business schools are telling you, here's the right answer. And the case method and the Socratic method are designed for you to walk in thinking about three things, but walk out thinking about eight. Now, you may not have changed your mind, you may still disagree with half your classmates about the right answer, but you've elevated your thinking and improved your ability to critical thinking, which I think is another hot button of yours as
well. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Another question? We got 5 minutes to go. I won't do another cold call, but we'll already got it.
Yes, I was wondering what your views were on mandatory national service and what the impact would be on armed services.
Yeah. Yes, I've got very mixed feelings. Mandatory national service, you know, can take a number of forms, right? I think some people, when they hear mandatory national service, they think of the draft. So when I was coming up as a young officer, in particular, a lot of the senior staff non-commissioned officers, gunnery sergeants and sergeants major and things like that, they had come in the era of the draft, in the Vietnam era and things like that. It was a very different force then. Having an all-volunteer, or more appropriately, an all-recruited professional force has massive, massive advantages. Conscripts, or draftees, are the most ineffective, inefficient people to put a weapon in their hand that you can imagine. So I'm not a fan of the draft as it existed then, but I am a fan of the idea of national service in some way. I don't know how practical it is. I've been part of panels here in DC on this very point. I do believe there should be better incentives. I don't know that you can drive everybody in the direction of some type of national service, a tour with the Peace Corps or fill in the blank, various things that could be done. I don't know that you can drive everybody or even want to drive everybody in a country our size. You could do that in Israel and smaller countries. In my experience, I've seen that, I've witnessed that. In the U.S., I think it would be deeply impractical. But we can incentivize things a little bit differently. There's a lot of conversations, maybe at a point close to many hearts in here, about relieving student debt and so on. Well, maybe there's some incentives that can be tied to that. Maybe there's some incentives that can be tied to additional money for education, graduate education, or whatever the case may be. I don't know what it is, but I don't want it to be military service.
Yeah, we just launched a book club at the faculty at Darden. And one of the books we were exploring is called Woke Incorporated, and how the social justice scam of corporate America. Basically arguing that all DEI and social justice, all this is just a scam that the government, the companies are using to attract people and dismiss attention to what they're doing. And we talked about it because, frankly, you dismissed stakeholder theory and said that's a fundamental cause. And one of the Darden faculty members is actually the originator of stakeholder theory, which is that it's more than shareholders that we need to think about in a business role. The example, the book was mostly talked about all the things that we didn't like about it. One of the most interesting things is, I never had heard before, was a recommendation that high school students spend their summer doing service. And I think about it, the character development of service is a good thing, and it's just part of your education process. And if it's to the right mix and match of charities, it's also breaking that bubble. You're going to go see people that you wouldn't see otherwise besides your community if you actually did. There's an interesting idea that I never, one takeaway from the book. So even that's books great. You don't like, you read, you can find something interesting in them
Absolutely.
If you try.
Absolutely. That's a great classic idea. But back to the idea of culture. We've got a very deep, deep libertarian streak in this country. Heck, we can't get people to wear masks at the peak of of a pandemic or other things like that, things done for the common good and so on. Getting people people have their kids invest an entire summer in that. I mean, you could hear the wailing and gnashing of teeth now, right? Nationwide, that's the government's overreach. You were pushing folks in. So how we'd handle this policy-wise, right? And how we'd communicate this.
Though, to close, I want to quote back one of the things you said to me before. One of the things that makes America great, as much as we might be careful about American exceptionalism, is that we are a country of ideas. And that's what defines us, is a set of ideas we hold true, not who we are by
ethnicity,
you know, race or ethnicity,
right,
or religion,
as many countries
species,
are. Yeah.
It is a melting pot of time. And thinking about those ideas and shaping those ideas and how we roll in both as business leaders, but also as members of society, I think is a big part of how we deal with this ideological divide, the hubris, exposure, and thinking about the right ideas. There's a handful of core ideas that are pretty good we can grab to.
If we can keep the faith in the good ideas and all the ideas that seem to be counterproductive societally, if we can push them further to the margins, this experiment will continue.
But it's always a balancing act.
Yeah,
as you said.
It is.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.